From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Political economist Bennett Harrison thinks the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, while the middle's getting smaller. On this edition of Fresh Air, Harrison talks about what he calls the great U-turn in the American standard of living. Last year, Los Lobos had the hit recording of La Bamba. Today, the group's drummer, Luis Perez, tells us about their new album of traditional Mexican music. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz introduces us to the work of Hungarian composer Gyorgy Kurtág. And in the wake of a political campaign filled with sound bites and one-liners, language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg sings the praises of a more time-honored type of quotation, the proverb. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Economist Bennett Harrison thinks America's economic recovery is an illusion. He says whatever growth we have experienced is bolstered by debt and military spending. Harrison focuses on how corporate decisions and federal policy have affected the standard of living of Americans. In 1982, he and economist Barry Bluestone co-authored the book The Deindustrialization of America. It analyzed the loss of jobs that resulted from plant closings and the relocation of industry from the North to the Sun Belt or out of the country altogether. Their new book, The Great U-Turn, looks at what's happening to Americans who do have jobs and why, for many of them, work and wages have taken a turn for the worse. My guest, Ben Harrison, is a professor at MIT, where he teaches political economy. During the presidential campaign, you may have had the question posed to you, are you better off now than you were 8 years ago? I asked Ben Harrison to answer that question as he thought it applied to the average American family.
The average American, whoever exactly that is going nowhere and has been going nowhere since the late 1970s. Family incomes are totally stagnant, although number of people in the average family are working harder, more hours, and so forth. Average wages are actually down a little bit, adjusted for inflation. But probably the most serious development in the American economy, the reason why we call the new book The Great U-Turn, what the turnaround is about, is in this extraordinary growth of low-wage employment. Between the end of World War II and roughly the mid-1970s, the proportion of new jobs created in the economy paying very low wages steadily declined. That was the sense of upward mobility and movement in the economy that working families could sense. But since the mid to late 1970s and right through the Reagan recovery, everything's turned around and it's exactly upside down. Since 1979, right through last year, for every one job created in the economy that pays above, say, $48,000 a year or so, most of us would call that a good job, high-paying job anyway, for every one of those, the American economy has created six jobs paying less than $12,000 a year, poverty wage jobs. That's the great U-turn in the American economy. So some people have certainly been better off in the 1980s, but an awful lot of people, perhaps the majority of people, are really slipping downhill.
So you think it's deceiving to just look at figures like how many jobs have been created? You think you have to look at the figure more carefully and say how many good jobs, how many well-paying jobs have been created?
Well, that's absolutely right. In the past, measures like the unemployment rate have had enormous political and social and psychological and cultural significance. I mean, the first Friday of every month, when the news anchors on all the television stations would read the monthly unemployment rate, all kinds of things would be triggered by that. The unemployment rate doesn't mean what it used to mean in the United States, because our problem in this country is not that we don't create enough employment. We have an awful lot of employment that we're creating, but the great majority of the employment that we're creating in this country, in almost all regions of the U.S. now, is low-paying, often part-time, work that does not include the kind of benefits, health insurance, paid sick leave, vacations, and so forth, that the parents of the present generation of young workers fought very hard for and became quite appropriately accustomed to receiving.
Let me cite an example that you give in your book, The Great U-Turn. You say that in Boston, the city where you live, in Boston, which is best known for its high-tech industry, its universities, its hospital system, the number one growth occupation is building custodian.
Yes, indeed. People think about places like Boston. And by the way, that same argument fits Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York City, Baltimore, some of the big cities that are going through this so-called urban revitalization. It's certainly true that some of what goes on in those big office towers and in the hotels next to them and the boutiques and the rest of it, it's certainly true that some of what goes on in there has to do with the daily work of lawyers and accountants and computer systems analysts and people who are specializing in analyzing foreign markets for as consultants to private companies. But mostly what's going on in those companies during the day is clerical workers doing their thing. And at night, what's going on in those buildings is janitors cleaning up and taking out trash. And there are a lot more of those clerical and janitorial jobs than there are of the other. The Reagan-Bush Labor Department itself has put out some very reliable numbers on this sort of thing, although we certainly haven't heard much of these things during the campaign for all the obvious reasons. But they've been counting which occupations are creating the most openings for people in the 1980s, and they've made forecasts right into the 1990s, almost to the end of the century. And they've come up with a list of the 10 occupations that are creating the most job openings during this period. And let me run down the list for a second.
Yeah,
it's absolutely fascinating, because I guess if all one did was watch television and go to the movies and think about getting one's sense about where the economy's going from these popular cultural images, the image would be stockbroker and computer programmer and so forth. But here are the 10 top occupations creating the most jobs in the United States over this period of time. Cashier is number one, registered nurse, janitor, truck driver, waiter and waitress, wholesale trade sales worker, somebody working in a warehouse, nurses, aides, and orderlies, retail sales clerks, accountants and auditors, kindergarten and elementary school teachers. And in the 1980s, just to wrap this point up, the industry which has created more new jobs in the United States as a whole than any other single industry, it's not computers, it's not automobiles, it's not semiconductors, it isn't the radio and television, it's food services. And in 1987, the average annual wage of a food service worker in the United States was $6,500. That's the reality that I'm afraid, particularly in this last presidential campaign, has been totally buried.
Your last book was about the closing down of many American industries and the flight of industrial jobs. Now we're witnessing a boom in the service sector. Do you think that all the new part-time jobs and low-paying jobs are a result of the increasing number of jobs in the service sector? Is the service industry necessarily offering part-time and low-paying jobs?
No, it's a little more complicated than that, but not very much more complicated than that, we think. On the average, the service sector pays much lower wages than manufacturing, is much less likely to offer the kind of benefits, again, that people quite have a right to be expecting. Health insurance and vacation and sick leave and some reasonably decent health and safety conditions in their workplace and so forth. Within the service sector, of course, there's enormous variation. In the parts of the service sector that are creating the most employment, I just mentioned food services and so forth, and that's also true at the wholesale level, wages are very low, and working conditions are often very, very bad. But in the 1980s, part of the low-wage job problem is happening within manufacturing as well. And it is a kind of second step in the process that began in the late 1970s and early 1980s that we, in the first book, called it deindustrialization. One of the reasons wages are declining inside the manufacturing is because a lot of big companies have, first of all, just been demanding wage cuts from their employees and threatening plant shutdowns if they don't get the wage cuts. And more often than not, workers are forced to give in. And this is a story of non-union workplaces as well as unions. It's not certainly not reserved to the union sector. But it's also true that one of the strategies of all too many American firms in the 1980s in order to try to improve their it's their particular way of trying to improve their competitive position vis-a-vis their foreign competitors. I want to argue in a minute that there are other ways, other paths not taken. But one of the ways American managers have been trying to deal with this in the 1980s is by farming out or subcontracting out, or to use the technical jargon that business people use, outsourcing work that used to be done inside a high-paid, often unionized work situation, outsourcing that work to smaller, low-wage suppliers located either within the United States or frequently outside the United States, on the Mexican border, elsewhere in Central America, in Southeast Asia. Simple example makes the point. 10 years ago, all of the janitors, we were talking about janitors a moment ago, so let's stay with that. All of the janitors who worked in the United States Steel Corporation, now called USX, were employees of USX, and their wages were set by the same collective bargaining agreements, the same arrangements that held for all the other employees of USX. Now, about 10% of all of USX's employment is actually farmed out to private contractors who hire people, some of them ex-USX workers who were laid off, and then get a job again at drastically lower wages. Come in, clean the plant, do work in the plant and so forth, but then go home at night, and they're employed by an outside company. The auto companies, GM, Ford especially, have farmed more and more and more. It seems never to end. It's gone again right through the economic recovery. More and more of their manufacturing activity to plants in other countries. GM manufactures more and more of its engines in Mexico City, seat belts and glove boxes and radios and the rest on the in the plants on the Mexican border, where people make a fraction of the wages that they make in the United States. So the low wage problem that we're seeing in the United States is happening within manufacturing and within service, as well as across the two, as the economy shifts more in the direction of being a service economy.
Let me reintroduce you. Bennett Harrison is my guest. He's a professor of political economy at MIT and co-author of the new book, The Great U-Turn, Corporate Restructuring and the Polarization of America. Now, you were saying that that the United States dealt with global competition by lowering wages, by laying people off, by outsourcing production. And you said that there were other ways, other more productive ways that they could have dealt with it. What examples would you offer?
Well, all of the competing companies in the countries that are engaged in international trade, Japan, Germany, Italy, Sweden, as well as the United States, all faced the same conditions in the early 1970s. They faced rising, intensified competition from one another, and they faced the oil shocks. They all faced basically the same conditions, but they dealt with them very differently. What our foreign competitors have done to a much greater extent than we have is, first of all, make major across-the-board investments in new state-of-the-art plant and equipment technology, in manufacturing and services and so forth. In the United States, almost all of our new investment for the last dozen years has been in one area, office automation. It's nice, it's useful, it's desirable. Yes, it contributes to productivity, but it's much too little and much too narrow a focus. We need to improve our capacity to make automobiles and to make steel and to make it easier for insurance salespeople to do their job by getting information in from the road and 100 other ways. So investment in plant and equipment technology is really important. Secondly, foreign countries have done a much better job than we have in improving the quality and the breadth of public education, in really getting more science and technology, technical training into a much larger share of their young people. Our schools are going to hell in a handbasket, while the schools in our foreign competitors' countries have been substantially improved, and they were already quite good to begin with. Especially Japan in this regard has made major, major advances. Thirdly, American companies have not made training efforts and retraining efforts with respect to the employees they already have. It's very common in the large firms of many of our foreign competitors to see those companies investing in the retraining of workers in their 30s and 40s to learn new skills, to learn how to use new equipment, to learn how to function in new kinds of ways. American companies just don't do that.
One thing that you would like change, one of the many things that you would like change to reverse the economy, is the end of a laissez-faire policy in the government. Can you give us some examples of what kinds of policies you'd like to see the government create to regulate business?
Well, I must say that since we started working on the book, which is maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I think a lot of the business community has caught up with at least part of our argument. The deregulation of private industry, certainly the deregulation of the financial industry, has clearly gone too far. The original theory about deregulation was it would promote competition and that would bring more firms into business and they'd all compete with one another and prices would go down for consumers and quality would go up for customers and we'd all be happily and live happily ever after. But financial deregulation has brought this tremendous boom in speculation. It's made it profitable for your local insurance company and credit card company to pretend that they're in the business of speculating in currencies. And it's helped to contribute to this war between private firms, to this intensified competition that in turn they try to then deal with by cutting wages. So the massive deregulation, the way it was done, it was done so quickly, it was done without any kind of planning. It had a certain set of objectives in mind, and what ended up happening was that it helped to contribute to declining wages through the intensified competition of companies, and it really has not improved the quality of airline service. I mean, think about whether or not you think in the late 1980s there are more and better and more reliable flights available to more places in the country than there were 10 years ago. The answer is no. There are still only four or five major airline companies. We still have the same degree of monopoly that we had before. And perhaps most seriously of all, financial deregulation, of all of the different forms of deregulation that the Carter administration and then the Reagan administration pursued, financial deregulation has fed this feeding frenzy of mergers and acquisitions among American companies. And all that does is waste money, waste human effort, and create a diversion from what ought to be the real business of American business, and that is how to make better products, more durable products, and compete more successfully in international markets.
I want to talk with you more about your critique of the American economy, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Bennett Harrison. He's a professor of political economy at MIT and co-author with Barry Bluestone of the new book, The Great U-Turn, Corporate Restructuring and the Polarization of America. And when we get back, one of the things we're going to talk about is Ben Harrison's analysis of the elections, what issues were addressed, and what the economic results of the elections might be. First, we'll take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Ben Harrison. We're talking about the subject of his book, The Great U-Turn, which is about a U-turn in economic policies that he thinks has created a U-turn in the average standard of living in America. Let's reflect on the elections for a little while. You're talking about economic issues that you think are real life and death issues to everybody in America. Do you think that these issues were adequately addressed in the presidential campaign that we just finished?
Well, my single biggest disappointment, critique, frustration with the Dukakis campaign is on precisely this question. If you go back to last winter and last spring during the primary season, all of the polls, all of the interviewers, all of the folks in the media like yourselves who were interviewing people around the country, all were reporting that they were detecting this kind of subsurface anxiety about what's going to happen to us? Our kids can't afford to buy a house. The average American family now carries twice as much installment debt, not including mortgages, twice as much installment debt as it carried in 1980. That's one of the legacies of the way in which the Reagan government has chosen to keep the economy expanding by promoting debt. It's not just federal deficit, it's also individual households. The average American household now carries about $11,600 in installment debt. That's plastic, auto loans, credit cards, and so forth. Yeah, I think that last winter and spring, as we went around the country and as reporters went around the country, they detected a great deal of concern about this. These numbers reflect a reality. But in American politics, as in politics anywhere, academic economists don't make people see the possibilities for articulating their concerns and demanding social change. That's the job of political leadership. And it was happening in the primaries. Some of it came through Gephardt's campaign. Of course, Jesse Jackson's campaign. Had Cuomo chosen to run, it would have been a central part of Cuomo's campaign. Cuomo produced a report in June in which these issues were central. But Mike Dukakis, for reasons that close friends of his suggest are very personal and deep, simply doesn't accept or doesn't like or doesn't seem to like arguments that smack of class, that recognize the existence of rich and poor, of a distinction between people making out well and people who are just barely making it at all.
Do you think that George Bush will continue the economic policies put in place by Ronald Reagan?
By and large, yes. That is, he has a very strong commitment to rolling back capital gains taxes in order to further improve the financial situation of those who live largely off income from royalties and rents and assets and interest and so forth. It's a very important commitment of his, just as Dukakis had a profound commitment to rejecting capital punishment as a moral issue, one for which I held him in enormous respect. Bush's commitment, conviction that the very rich really need to have even more income in order to increase their savings and so forth is a real conviction of his. And yeah, I think he'll try to push that. So I would expect a continuation, by and large, of the economic and social policies, many of the social policies of the Reagan administration. The question really is, how much longer can the economy go before people who are suffering the kind of squeeze, at best a squeeze, and for many, we call it a skidding downward, experiencing reduced wages and reduced incomes, how long before those people start voting with their feet, articulating their concern, demanding social change? And who can make such a prediction, and who wants to make predictions like that? They're very difficult and a bit frightening. All I'm willing to suggest is that things have been held together by chewing gum for the last 8 years, especially in terms of the enormous deficit and indebtedness that's enabled people to maintain their consumption, even though their real earnings have stagnated or declined.
I've heard several people say that with the national debt being as huge as it is, that no matter who was elected, Democrat or Republican, that the economy was really in danger of collapsing the next 4 years, and whoever was in office would take credit for it, but there was so much momentum, there was virtually nothing that they'd be able to do to stop it. What do you think of that point of view?
I am, the economist part of me is generally in sympathy with the analysis that suggests that the underlying problems, too large a deficit, too large a foreign trade deficit, this stubborn, profound competitiveness problem, which is real, it's not rhetorical. We really are not able to compete well with 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 different foreign countries in products and services which we ourselves were very good at, that the chickens are going to come home to roost. We're going to sooner or later have a major recession, and the power of the government to help minimize the pain from that recession through policies which have been developed over the last half century has been very much compromised by a variety of changes in the way the world works. So the economist in me is sympathetic to the prediction that whoever is in the White House is going to have a tough 4 years. But the human being in me and the political citizen in me strongly resists the notion that it's irrelevant who's in the White House, because if nothing else, the occupant of the White House has an enormous amount to do with deciding who bears the pain, how the burden of pain is shared, and which of many possible paths out of economic difficulty we choose to take. The Democrats in general, and certain Democrats, I would suggest Cuomo and Jackson in particular, have been extremely specific about how they would see the burden of difficulties shared among the population. They would not sacrifice housing. They would not sacrifice health care. They would not sacrifice basic concern for the rebuilding of especially the small and medium-sized companies in the United States, their capacity to become more productive and more modern. They've made those commitments very clear. And those aren't questions of just spending money. They're questions of shuffling budgets around, of course. But they also have to do with regulatory control and public leadership, just articulating public leadership. So I think that what we've done now to ourselves by electing Bush president is we've shot ourselves in both feet. We're going to pay down the road, perhaps in the next 4 years, for the economic consequences of a mismanaged economy. And we've put into the White House someone whose fairly explicit commitment about how to share the burdens is that you first of all got to protect them that's got.
Let me guess at what might be a fundamental paradox that you have to confront in your life. And that is that economic issues, workplace issues, these are issues that really affect the way each of us live. I mean, they affect the income that we make, the way we can spend our money, and so on. Yet, there seems to be an almost national mental block at really discussing some of the economic issues that face us. Maybe because they're complex, maybe because they're hard to handle in 60-second sound bites. But do you feel that that's true, that the issues that you're devoting your life to, that you know are life and death issues, that it's somehow hard to address them in a national forum?
It was easier to talk about the problem of plant shutdowns and job loss and total unemployment back in the early 1980s when Bluestone and I did our first book, The Deindustrialization of America, than it has been to talk about this problem of stagnant or declining wages and the growth of low-wage jobs. Now, we've asked ourselves 1,000 times this fall, as the book came out, we've been traveling around the country and not only doing a lot of media work, but as is our way, spending lots of times with trade union locals and community development organizations, church groups. That's really, I suppose, if we were in politics, those would be our constituencies. And that's how we do our research. We spend half of our time in a computer center and half of our time traveling around the country, sleeping on people's couches, and visiting their workplaces and taking notes. They don't have any trouble. That is, working people don't have any trouble talking in 1988 about the difficulty of getting by when your wages are declining, or when even though three people in the family are working, the whole overall family is still making no more money than it made back in 1978 or 79. They don't have any trouble telling us that. It is indeed a problem of articulating it at the national level. I'm no expert on the never-ending debate about how the design of television and radio, especially more than print journalism, affect politics. It's a raging debate. It will never end. I have lots of friends who are involved in it. I'm sure you do. I suspect some of our listeners are part of that debate professionally. My own direct experience is, yes, it's become much more difficult to make halfway complicated technical arguments about economics, even in 1988 than it was in 1982, even about such fairly straightforward things as how are you doing, how are your wages, and so forth.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Terry.
My guest has been Bennett Harrison, and his new book is called The Great U-Turn, Corporate Restructuring and the Polarizing of America. It was co-authored with Barry Bluestone, and it's published by Basic Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with American theater's leading composer, Stephen Sondheim. His musicals include Sweeney Todd, Company, Folly, Sunday in the Park with George, and the current Broadway hit, Into the Woods. I hope you can join us.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd. His skin was pale and his eye was odd. He shaved the faces of gentlemen who never thereafter were heard of again. He trod a path that few have trod. Did Sweeney Todd. A demon barber of Fleet Street. He kept a shop in London town.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Louis Perez says that around his house, La Bamba is referred to as the B word. That's because Perez's band Los Lobos had been playing Mexican music for years, but hit it big with a remake of the song Richie Valens made famous. Coming up, Louis Perez talks about the new Los Lobos record, a collection of traditional and contemporary Mexican songs. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the music of Hungarian composer Gyorgy Kurtág. Lloyd says it's not easy to find Kurtág's music in this country, but his musical settings of poems are worth the search. And he may just be crying over spilled milk, but language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg laments the decline of proverbs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Dale Willman. Former Attorney General John Mitchell has died of a heart attack in Washington. He was 75 years old. A spokeswoman for George Washington died this evening after collapsing earlier on the street. Mitchell served during the Nixon administration and was regarded as the closest cabinet advisor to President Richard Nixon. He served a 19-month prison sentence for conspiracy, obstruction of justice, and lying under oath in connection with the Watergate cover-up. President-elect George Bush says he wants his campaign chairman, James Baker, to become his Secretary of State. Baker was a key figure in the Reagan administration. He last served as Treasury Secretary before leaving to run the Bush campaign. Bush spoke with reporters one day after his 8-point victory over Michael Dukakis. Meanwhile, Michael Dukakis said today he gave it his best shot. At a news conference in Boston, Dukakis congratulated Bush on what he called a decisive victory and promised to return vigorously and fully to his duties as governor of Massachusetts. Dukakis acknowledged that he erred by not challenging the distortions and deceptions which became the centerpiece of the Bush campaign.
Well, I don't think there's any question that the negativism we had in this campaign is something that had an impact on me, and I hope it doesn't happen, but I fear that this will be a signal now at the national level that this kind of campaigning is effective campaigning. I certainly hope not.
Dukakis was asked about Bush's choice of the man who designed that negative campaign, James Baker, as Secretary of State. Dukakis said, "I believe in the redemption of souls." Secretary of State George Shultz today gave his blessing to the man President-elect Bush will nominate as the new head of the State Department. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
James Baker III is a veteran of the Reagan administration, having first served as the president's chief of staff, then switching over to run the Treasury Department in 1985. Today at the State Department, Secretary Shultz praised his designated successor.
Jim Baker is an old friend and a man I have long admired and worked with closely and intensively. President-elect Bush's announcement that he will nominate Jim Baker to be the 61st Secretary of State is a welcome and heartening event.
The announcement comes as no surprise, since Baker widely had been rumored to be Bush's first choice to head the State Department. As for Shultz, he is known to have wanted to return to teaching in California. Until then, he will attend an Organization of American States meeting in El Salvador next week and a NATO meeting next month. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Maryland citizens rejected a proposition to repeal the state's 6-month-old handgun control law. The proposition had the support of the National Rifle Association, which funded a $4 million war chest. Today, the Air Force grounded all 98 of its B-1B bombers after one of the long-range bombers crashed yesterday near Abilene, Texas. More from NPR's David Malpas.
The Strategic Air Command calls the suspension of flight operations a normal precaution after an accident and says the planes, which cost $280 million each, will be grounded only long enough to conduct safety inspections. The inspections, which are likely to take about 3 hours per plane, are due to begin almost immediately. The B-1s will resume flying as each passes inspection. Air Force officials say they don't know the cause of yesterday's crash, and mechanics conducting the safety check will simply be looking for signs of wear, leaks, or anything else that might cause a problem. Another B-1 crashed last September, which led to a $40 million program to strengthen the bomber's wings. A pelican-sized bird had brought that plane down after hitting a vital part of the wing. Officials say the B-1's alert status remains unchanged, that it could still be used in a wartime emergency if needed. I'm David Malpas in Washington.
On Wall Street today, stocks closed lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 9 points to close today at 2118.24. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Over the past few months, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has introduced us to the work of several contemporary Eastern European musicians. Today he has a review of a recent album by Hungarian composer Gyorgy Kurtág. Lloyd says the music is difficult, but rewards repeated listening. Some of it, like this song, Hurdy-Gurdy Waltz, is even comic.
Last summer at the Monadnock Music Festival in New Hampshire, and a week later at the Festival of Contemporary Music at Tanglewood, the hills of New England were alive with the sound of Gyorgy Kurtág. Audiences were treated to, or confronted with, the first American performances of the Hungarian composer's song cycle, Kafka Fragments, sung by Adrienne Csengery, the soprano for whom they were written, and who seems to be Kurtág's muse. I couldn't get to those performances, but people were excited about them. There isn't much Kurtág on records, but I did find an LP on the Hungariton label made a couple of years ago that includes Csengery in two earlier Kurtág song cycles, Messages of the Late R.V. Trusova and Scenes from a Novel. Like the Kafka series, which contains many short fragments excerpted from Kafka's letters and diaries, both of these cycles consist mainly of short, haiku-like poems in Russian by the poet Dalos Rima. Messages of the Late R.V. Trusova is the more ambitious of the two cycles, 21 poems divided into three sections, Loneliness, A Little Erotic, and the longest section, Bitter Experience, Delight, and Grief. The poems reticently trace the progress of an extremely sensual, occasionally tender, but ultimately unhappy relationship. The vocal line owes a lot, maybe too much, to the hyper-romantic expressionism of Berg and Schoenberg. There's even a little bit of the musicalized speech inflection Schoenberg called Sprechstimme. Csengery, who has sung Mozart heroines at Glyndebourne and gone on to heavier roles, is a powerful interpreter. But there's even greater variety, freshness, and delicacy in the accompaniment, played on this recording by the greatest chamber group in the world, the Ensemble Intercontemporain, under the direction of its founder, Pierre Boulez. There are also solo passages for the cimbalom, a Hungarian version of the dulcimer, a stringed instrument struck with hammers. The soloist, Marta Fabian, makes it feel both sinister and nostalgic. Here are two consecutive poems from the Bitter Experience section, complete. The first, Love Me, says, Love me, forgive me, my wishes are so simple. The second, called Account, says, An eye for an eye, love for love, and then the sweet shame of the balance paid by installments. The cycle ends with more resignation than bitterness. Quote, "For everything we did together at some time, I'm paying." The other cycle on the album, Scenes from a Novel, uses only three instruments, cymbalom, violin, and double bass. Kurtag's inventiveness undercuts the poetic melodrama. He even makes jokes. The album closes with an independent song, The Brief Farewell, poignantly sung by Csengeri, who is accompanied this time by the composer himself.
Adrian Csengeri and Gheorghe Kurtag. Lord Schwartz reviewed an album of Kurtag's music on the Hungariton label. Lord is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. Los Lobos playing a song co-written by their drummer, my guest Luis Perez. Los Lobos plays a lot of original rock music, but they've become best known for their recording of La Bamba from the movie about Chicano rock and roll star Richie Valens. The founding members of Los Lobos are of Mexican descent and grew up in East Los Angeles. Their previous records have featured several traditional Mexican songs, but their new album is exclusively regional Mexican music, with the exception of one original song. Their new album, La Pistola y el Corazón, opens with a traditional song called La Guacamaya.
Pobrecita guacamaya, ay, que lastima me das. Que lastima me das, pobrecita guacamaya.
Se acabaron las petallas, ahora sí que comerán.
It's interesting that you've chosen to do this record after the success of La Bamba. I don't know if your company considers this an especially commercial idea for a record.
Well, it was never intended to be a very commercial sort of thing. It was something that that we felt really strongly about. And it's sort of our responsible way of responding to success, you know, to do something that's in the way we feel constructive. You know, we're playing music that people probably have never heard before. You know, people usually connect Mexican music with that of mariachi music, which is something that a type of music that comes from one particular region, and we're playing music on this record that exemplifies different music from many different parts of Mexico. So that's the sort of thing that we're excited about being able to present on this effort.
Are most of the songs on this record songs that you knew when you were growing up?
Well, not exactly. Growing up, Mom had, Mexican music on the radio and records and that sort of thing. And we went through the period of like any adolescent, rejecting the sort of things that are connected to your culture and your parents. And we went through that. As soon as we got, tall enough to reach the knob on the radio, it flipped over to whatever was going on in, mainstream music. It was after we became musicians, in high school that we became sort of frustrated with the trends in music, and over the following 8 years we did, you know, specifically just regional Mexican music, and just really involved in exploring the different territories and different instrumentation and vocal treatments and all that.
So did you go to musicians and sit in with them, try to listen to them play a lot?
Yeah, well,
get them to teach you things.
Yeah, the thing is that we hunted out people. We'd go down to find street musicians, and people milling around and just trying to find out what's this and what's that, and how do you tune these things. Once we found them at the pawn shop for like $15,
what Mexican instruments you're talking about?
Mexican instruments, right? Everybody was buying electric guitars back then, so we were able to find these instruments cheap, and we'd kind of hold up the cover of a record and say, hey, yeah, there's one in that window at the pawn shop, and pick it up. And at that point, we'd have to learn how to tune it and how to play it, and it took a while.
Let me ask you about one of the specific songs on your new album, Las Amarillas.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the song, how you first heard it.
Well, that particular one has a sort of interesting kind of background, because that was handed to us by this folkloric dance group that wanted us to learn the song to back them up on this, dance presentation they were going to have. But that particular song comes from the state of Guerrero, and that's a huapango, which is the sort of rhythm and sort of dance that goes along with it.
Volaron las amarillas, calandrias de los nopales. Ya no cantarán alegres los pájaros cadernales. A la tira la la la, a la tira la la no. Ya no cantarán alegres los pájaros cadernales. Árboles de la Alameda, ¿por qué no han reverdecido? Por eso calandrias canten, con la zapatilla el nido. A la tira na na na, a la tira na na no.
I know during the early 1980s, Los Lobos used to play some of the punk clubs in Los Angeles. And what seems to me what would be a good outcome of that is that it would prevent you from ever getting sanctimonious about playing traditional music.
Yeah, well, naturally, we wanted a place to play. We wanted to be able to play our own music. And, the early, punk music was just, to me, it was just it was so sincere. The mm-hmm. approach was most of these guys didn't even know how to play, but it was just a certain energy and a certain honesty that was, attracted me. And then after discovering that kind of music, I found out that also within that new music movement, there was also this, revival of what they called roots music, which was, the rockabilly and R&B and that sort of thing. And at that point, we realized that there would be some sort of room for a group like us. So we played our Mexican music and our rock and roll, and we sort of came out of this sort of gray area where our community, people from East LA, thought we had lost our minds and we had become punk rockers or something. And then the community, the music, new music community, hadn't figured us out yet either. So it was like this, we were leaving, playing a wedding that would pay us like, maybe $400 on a Saturday afternoon, leaving that behind to play a little punk club and chase the promoter down the street for your $50.
How do you think your rock and roll background affects your interpretations of traditional music?
I couldn't imagine playing this music without the rock and roll background that we had, because it did just really set us up and introduced us to the whole musical thing in order to apply that to what we do now. And I think that the rock and roll sort of background that we've had affected our sort of approach, in that we didn't take a very purist, total purist sort of standpoint in the music. We didn't say, well, it has to be this way or it has to be that way. But then at the same time, that too was tempered with the love of the particular style and the tradition, so we wanted to keep it still pure, but we weren't on that very purist, ethnic music level.
The last song on your new album is a song that you co-wrote with David Hidalgo. You wrote the lyrics. The song is called La Pistola y el Corazón.
Uh-huh.
Did you write this song in the style of a particular region of Mexico?
Well, the idea was to mix it up, to do a sort of like a mixture of styles, and it actually starts off in this kind of a huapango, and then it goes into a slower thing, and then the chorus actually goes into this like a ranchera, a section that's in a major scale, where the rest of it's in a minor scale. So that was the idea to approach this in a way that it would be more like a mixture of Mexican music, and I don't know, I'm pretty happy with the way it came out.
La luna me dice una cosa, las estrellas me dicen otra, la luz del día me canta esta triste canción, esta triste canción. Los besos que me diste, mi amor, son los que me están matando, ya mis lágrimas se están secando con mi pistola, mi corazón. Y aquí siempre paso la vida con la pistola y el corazón.
We heard from Luis Perez of Los Lobos. The group is currently on tour, playing songs from their new album La Pistola y el Corazón. In the next 10 days, they'll play in Boston, New York, Washington, D.C., Chicago, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what they're planning on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
Say, I've been busy. Who won the elections? Oh, only kidding.
Well, we will look at the Bush victory. Also at the Democratic victories in the Senate and in the House of Representatives from a number of different angles. Who voted according to all the exit polls that Cokie Roberts looked at, and what lies ahead for the Democrats. And, of course, the president-elect's announcement today that he's already decided on his Secretary of State. No big surprise. It's going to be James Baker. And what Baker as Secretary of State might likely mean, and what some of our friends and allies around the world are making of the result.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg thinks the ability to pull out an appropriate proverb should count for more than delivering a quick one-liner. But unfortunately, he says, American proverbs have seen better days.
You recall when Gorbachev was visiting the White House last year and Reagan quoted a Russian proverb meaning trust but verify? A lot of people found this charming, but I was a little miffed, the way some people might feel if the White House served French wine or Argentine beef to a visiting head of state. Why couldn't Reagan have used an American proverb like, don't buy a pig in a poke, or smile but cut the cards? In a country like Russia or Italy, a proverb or two is obligatory in any political speech as a nod to solidarity with the people. And proverbs used to be the staple of old-style American campaigners like Harry Truman and Sam Ervin. But in recent political campaigns, proverbs have been as rare as hen's teeth. In their place, we get one-liners lifted from hamburger commercials and Clint Eastwood movies. Maybe part of the reason was that this year's crop of candidates was not what you'd call a folksy group. But I also have the feeling that this kind of folk wisdom simply doesn't cut it nowadays. We've come to the point where a proverb is without honor in our own country. When I talk about proverbs, I don't mean just general maxims like take life as it comes. A true proverb is a kind of miniature allegory that has to be interpreted metaphorically. Something like, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander, or don't count your chickens before they're hatched. Every language has its proverbs, it seems, and their morals are remarkably similar, maybe because common sense leads to the same banal conclusions in Omaha, Oslo, or Osaka. What gives proverbs their particular punch is the way they tell their tale. For example, when we practical Anglo-Saxons want to say, if you're going to do it at all, do it up big, we say, in for a penny, in for a pound. But in Yiddish, the matter is put on a gastronomic basis. If you're going to eat pork, may it run from your mouth. In English, you can't get blood from a stone. In Irish, you can't get pants off a naked ass. We say, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. The Romans put it differently. They say, when you're at the ball, you have to dance. And in Hindi, you say, in the land where people eat snakes, you should grab the middle piece. Sometimes it's not easy to figure out what other people's proverbs mean. What do the Poles have in mind when they say, love is not a potato? Or what do the Finns mean when they say, my country strawberries, your country blueberries? Is this like, the grass is always greener, or like, there's no place like home? I asked my Finnish friend Lowry, who told me, it's clear you've never tasted Finnish strawberries, to which I answered, or maybe the Finns have never tasted Maine blueberries. Of course, our own proverbs are not always clear, not even to ourselves. Everybody says, a rolling stone gathers no moss, for example, but some people use it to mean stay home and others to mean keep moving. But sometimes you find a foreign proverb which has no English equivalent and which is so apt that you want to take it home with you. There's the one from the Caucasus languages that goes, the man who tells the truth must keep his horse saddled. And then there's the greatest of all Russian proverbs, the farther you go into the forest, the deeper the dung. Although I hope you'll understand that the English word dung doesn't quite do justice to the Russian original. But like most souvenirs of foreign travel, there'd really be no place to put these once you got them home. To the generations of Americans raised on the one-liner culture of Laugh-In and The Tonight Show, proverbs are irredeemably cornball. As my Polish grandmother would have said, when the zingers start to fly, the proverb goes to ground.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, Memories of Amnesia. We speak with Lauren Shainberg about his new novel, about a neurosurgeon whose brain turns against him. To research the book, Shainberg profiled a famous neurosurgeon. Also, the return of the supergroup. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews The Traveling Wilburys, a revival of an old rock concept. This supergroup is made up of Bob Dylan, George Harrison, Roy Orbison, and Tom Petty. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews A Cry in the Dark, starring Meryl Streep. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Vablaitis. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. NPR, National Public Radio.